Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Welcome back to another episode of Sci-Fi on Screen. This week we're going to be talking about episode 5, The Empire Strikes Back. But before I get to that, I want to do some housekeeping. I want to give a shout out to a couple of people who've been contacting me about the podcast. I want to give a shout out to a guy named Brock Barth, who has been trying to get comments posted on my site, and it was telling me that this was kind of getting kicked back. So if anyone else out there is having issues posting comments on the website, please shoot an email to me at scifionscreen@gmail.com and let me know, because that means I got to go to WordPress and, you know, dig out what the hell's going on. Brock wrote a comment on the Ghost in the Shell post. He said, quote, "Ghost in the Shell is an incredible film. On the surface, it seems like a typical action film, but honestly, there is a lot going on in it. It asks some deep questions about identity and what it means to be. Like you mentioned, it is probably a bit much for American audiences. I really would prefer that they don't try to make a live-action film of it, because they just won't do it right," end quote. Brock, I completely agree with you. I know that someone has got, this American company has the rights, and they've signed Scarlett Johansson to play Major Motoko, and they are going to strip it down of any difficult intellectual or sexual or anything and make it a PG-13 shoot 'em up, and it's going to suck balls. You know, I'm making that prediction on tape here, 2015, in the month of July, that The Ghost in the Shell, you know, unless a miracle happens and they rope in, or like the George Miller miracle, where he gets like a $200 million R movie made, to having made virtually nothing in like 20, 30 years. Also, there's another post by someone named Alexandria Jankowski on the site. She writes, I'm assuming it's a she, "My spouse and I absolutely love your blog and find almost all of your posts to be just what I'm looking for. Does one offer guest writers to write content available for you? I wouldn't mind producing a post or elaborating on a lot of the subjects you write with regards to here." Again, awesome site. Alexandria, I don't really do guest writers and guest content. I'm toying with ideas of adding to the format, because I do my original versus remake. I did a special lightsaber duel one. Then, of course, I do my scene-by-scene main shows. I'm thinking about, you know, at some point, maybe finding a way to have a roundtable or have guests on. I just haven't gotten to it yet. I kind of have my format down, and but I would like to expand it. So anyway, I appreciate the sentiments, and answer is no, and thank you. So let's get to Empire Strikes Back. Star Wars obviously exceeded all expectations in terms of profit and revolutionized the film industry along with Jaws, blah, 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 right? Lucas really wanted to become independent from the film industry by financing Empire himself. I think it was like $33 million from loans and the previous film's earnings, and going against the principles of, like, at that time, Hollywood producers never to invest one's own money in the product, right, of course. But he did, and he emancipated himself from the studio system right away. He chose not to direct it because he had a ton of other production roles. He was overseeing his special effects company, Industrial Light and Magic, ILM, which was coming up now, so that was coming out of the box. The Byzantine roles of handling all the financing, so he offered the director role to a guy named Irvin Kershner, who was one of his professors at USC. Kershner was known mostly for smaller-scale, character-driven films. He recently had directed this true-life drama, Raid on Entebbe, 1977, and The Eyes of Laura Mars, 1978. So Kersh initially turned Lucas down, citing his belief that a sequel would never meet the quality or originality of Star Wars. Then supposedly he called his agent, who immediately demanded that he take the job. So the word was kind of getting out, like, the, you know, the incredible pivotal nature of Star Wars and what was going to happen to the industry. So Lucas hired a science fiction writer by the name of Lee Brackett to write the first draft of Empire Strikes Back. Brackett had written a ton of science fiction short stories in the 1950s. She kind of became a screenwriter in the late 60s, early 70s, co-wrote some films, wrote some films as well. So they held some story conferences, and by late November 1977, Lucas had produced a handwritten treatment called The Empire Strikes Back. And the treatment is similar to the final film, except that in this treatment, Darth Vader does not reveal he is Luke's father, which is kind of interesting. In the first draft that Brackett would write, Luke's father, actual father, appears as a ghost to instruct Luke, which is kind of interesting. So Brackett finished her first draft in 78. Lucas has said now that he was initially very disappointed with it, but she died of cancer very quickly after she handed it in. So no chance to really talk about it with her. And so he had to write the next draft himself. And we hear that it was in this draft that Lucas first made use of the episode numbering for the films, that there was Empire Strikes Back was listed as episode 2 in this draft. And there's a guy named Michael Kaminsky who wrote a book called The Secret History of Star Wars. The disappointment with the first draft probably made Lucas consider different directions in which to take the story. And then he makes use of a new plot twist that Darth Vader claims to be Luke's father. According to Lucas, he found this draft enjoyable to write as opposed to the year-long struggle writing the first film and quickly wrote two more drafts. So obviously, this new story point of Darth Vader being Luke's father had a drastic effect on the series. Kaminsky argues that in his book, it is unlikely that the plot point had ever seriously been considered or even conceived of before the writing of Empire. The first film was clearly operating under an alternate storyline. And so with the new backstory in place, Lucas then decided that the series would be a trilogy, changing Empire Strikes Back from episode 2 to episode 5. Thinking that there would be an initial prequel trilogy, so on and so forth. And then he enlisted Lawrence Kasdan, who had just completed writing Raiders, so he knew of Lawrence. And Kasdan then wrote the next few drafts and was given some input by Kirshner and Gary Kurtz, who kind of seriused up the film, as it were. They were talking to Kasdan about they wanted to be more of a film of serious tone than Star Wars was. And the storyline got a little darker. A film like this, like, what am I going to say about Empire Strikes Back that hasn't been said? Probably nothing. So I want to approach it from just me personally, an extremely subjective personal view. And boy, I remember that when I was a kid, I used to get the magazine Starlog. Starlog was publishing set reports from Empire before it was even, you know, while it was filming. So I remember getting my hot hands on a Starlog magazine and reading all about the Norway shoot, you know, like they were shooting the Hoth sequences up in Norway and seeing the sets and, you know, Luke's costume and a picture of the Tauntaun and just flipping out completely. And another part of the magazine, seeing the Elstree Studios set in the UK, the Dagobah set. And I remember personally, the Empire Strikes Back novelization came out before the film did. And I gobbled it up. At that point, I didn't care about spoilers. I was like so desperate for any. I think the only thing that had come out after Star Wars was Splinter of the Mind's Eye, which I had read rabidly, which I think ultimately was. There was also this scuttlebutt that Splinter was going to originally a script that had been written for a possible sequel. But when that was discarded, they went with Empire that Dean Foster turns into a novel. I don't know much about that. I'd be curious to read a little bit more. But anyway, I remember plowing through the novelization on my dad's couch and just, you know, losing it when I got to the part of I Am Your Father. Just incredible. So, I mean, when I went to see Empire for the first time, I knew everything was going to happen. Still didn't care. Still loved it. So that's a little bit of background on Empire. I'm going to just jump right in. One caveat, I am using the latest Blu-ray, unfortunately. I was loaned this Blu-ray collection by my friend, and it has like the up-to-date, you know, all six films in Blu-ray format, which means, obviously, it's the special editions with all the crap added. So I can eyeball pretty much the stuff that he stuck in, so I kind of know, you know, what the additions are, but I apologize in advance if I describe something in the film that was not in the original film and it is in the special editions because, you know, I'm trying to do the original versions of the original trilogy because I find them just the best, you know. So we're seeing Star Destroyers launching these monstrous probe droids. Very cool. We see one enter Hoth and crash land, and I love the great sound design of the probe droid. It has this weird little like language that it speaks. You can tell that it's the probe droid language, right? Very neat. We get Tauntauns with the cool Harryhausen-like stop-motion photography, which they use for the Tauntauns and the walkers and a lot of stuff on Hoth. It's really cool. And we, you know, we see Luke again. He sees the probe droid impact. He's about to check it out, but he gets attacked by the goofy-looking Wampa ice creature, which makes me think of, like, the Abominable Snowman in those stop-motion animation films back in the, you know, like the 50s or the 60s, I think, with Burl Ives. It's kind of goofy looking. And then we get the interior of the Hoth base. We see Han again. And, you know, the interior of this base really reminded me of the Yavin base. Very cool. You know, lots of life-size models of the X-Wings. And we see a full-scale model of the Falcon, which is really cool. Chewie's fixing it. We're in the command center, and we get the plot point of Solo telling General Rekin that he's leaving. He has to pay off his debts. Leia gives him kind of a hard, you know, a hard-faced send-off. I love when he's like, don't get all mushy on me, and she's like, Han, yes, your highnessness, like, your worship and your highnessness, like, it's just, it's really cool and cute. And there's great back and forth between them in the hallway, which is the spirit of a first film, you know. I would soon kiss a Wookiee. I could arrange that. Like, it's just the banter between the two of them is right on key in Empire. And, you know, right off of, we're kind of continuing on from Star Wars. Like, they didn't miss a beat, you know, like, it's right on key. So then we meet 3PO and R2 again. Luke is somehow overdue. Han is kind of takes control, and he's the only one who goes out to get him. You know, we'll have to go out in Tauntauns. I'll see you in hell, right? His great line. And then we cut to Luke in the Wampa cave, right? He's upside down. His face is a mess. Some nice tension. You know, he hears the creature in the background chowing down, and, you know, he lets go to the Force, and we get the saber, and he drops, and the John Williams cue, right? When he's using the Force, we hear the John Williams kind of music cue come up. It's really cool. Cuts off the arm of the Wampa ice creature. Not the best effects sequence. And then he's out crawling away. So then we're back at base. We get the drama, right, of the blast doors needing to be closed. And, you know, they're like, we have to close the doors. And Luke's still out in it. And there's this great moment when the doors finally close, and Han and Luke are still out there. And then we cut to Luke, and we see Ben, our first Force ghost appearance ever, and he gets the download on Dagobah and Yoda. Then, you know, it's great. Han, we're seeing Ben, and then we see a Tauntaun kind of morph into where Ben was, and it's Han. He finds him, and the Tauntaun dies, and he uses the lightsaber. I think there's some trivia where it's like he's the only non-Jedi to ever use, you know, a lightsaber in the trilogies, other than in this trilogy, I guess, other than Vader, you know. So there's the great line. He cuts the Tauntaun open. I thought they smelled bad on the outside. So then we cut to, it's a beautiful Hoth morning. And, you know, there's some tension, but of course it's mostly moot, right? And then we see the snow speeders, and the snow speeders are great. I built models of these things when I was a kid. They're just like these squat little mini tanks with these cool, and I love the steering fins on the back that kind of go up and down. And it's cool that Lucas did it when he did the upcoming battle. You see the steering vanes move, and it's very cool. Same technique they use shooting as Death Star, where, you know, when you're shooting full on the pilot, it's a real vehicle. They really built it, and it really looks real. The only problem here is he's starting to use CGI in Empire. The exterior shots of the snowspeeders zipping around, they don't look so great, you know, because it was brand new CGI. I think there was some model use in certain aspects, but already there's a fakeness about things in Empire that there was not in Star Wars, which, you know, I'll comment on as we go. So then there's Luke in the back to tank, Han's line, that's to you, Omi Jr. And then, of course, there's these restrictions that they can't let anyone leave until the energy shield is up and running, and the Leia and Han have their back and forth, and laser brains and Nerf herder and everything. And, of course, there's the creepy kiss. Leia kisses Luke. I guess you don't know anything about women. And once you've gotten to their brother and sister, it's just creepy. End of story. And then they discover the probe droid, and they send Han and Chewie out, and they destroy it. Always struck me as, like, man, they just set this base up. Like, they just got there. The snowspeeders haven't been adapted for the cold yet. They built this whole base, and one bloody probe droid drops, and they gotta take off and leave. You know, like, it's just funny that the rebel discipline, as it were. So then we get a shot of the Imperial fleet, and we're getting an immediate escalation in size, right? So first we see a group of regular size Star Destroyers, which, if you think about, you know, in Star Wars, we had the Star Destroyers as, like, the biggest ships you could possibly imagine, and they were dwarfed by the Death Star. But here, they're dwarfed by this massive new Super Star Destroyer, which is, like, 8 to 10 times the size. And it's cool because we don't see it at first. We see this shadow slowly overtaking the other destroyers as it's coming from above. And then we see the massive size of the Superstar Destroyer, just the city in space. Like, it's such a cool design. And then we see Vader from behind. First time we see Vader. You know, there's this moment where the guys on Vader's flagship are like, ah, that's not the rebels. It's just, you know, there's thousands of settlements. And, of course, he walks over and he's like, that's the system. The rebels are there. Because, you know, obviously connected to the Force where he just knows. Also, something I remember noticing back then, too, is that Vader's helmet now has a very high gloss on it. In Star Wars, it was like a matte finish, but like in now for the rest of the series, like it is glossy. So then, after another cutback, we get another shot of the Superstar Destroyer, and we really see that it is a massive city in space and how beautiful it is. And then we get our first look at Vader's meditation pod, which this is a new thing that, you know, evil geniuses sit in meditation pods and meditate. What we're getting is that there's an energy field. They came out of light speed too close to the system. There's an energy field around one of the planets. Admiral Ozl came out of light speed too close to the system. So this is the beginning of Vader's basic decimation of the Imperial command staff. And it's great. Vader gets Ozl and Piet on the monitor. And he's giving Captain Piet new directions. At the same time, he's force-choking Ozl to death. And at the end of it, he's like, promotes Piet to Admiral. It's just like, oh, man. This is the film where Vader really earns his stripes as, like, the villain, you know, like the greatest villain, screen villain ever. So then we get Leia describing the exit plan, which is kind of cool, actually. You know, they open the energy shield briefly. There's a transport and two X-Wings. And there's this ion cannon on the planet, and the energy shield is opened briefly. The ships escape, and like several bolts from the ion cannon sort of zip past them and intercept anything in their path. It's very cool, very cool. And I like that Leia is briefing the pilots, you know, like she's down on the deck, as it were. And outside, we get the preparations for the surface assault. And it's a very cool-looking set. You know, they filmed in Norway, so it's, you know, it's really winter. You know, the turrets and the trenches that are there, like, it really looks solid. And even to this day, like, it's pretty good setup. And then immediately after, we get a demonstration of Leia's plan, and we see the shield opening and the Star Destroyer getting hit by the ion cannon. The transports get away. Just, you know, very cool strategy. The ion cannon's cool. Like, you know, it's just, and that's how they're gonna roll. So then we get, you know, the rebels realize it's going to be a ground assault, right? So we get the very first shots of the walkers in the distance through the lens of these powered binoculars, which same kind that Luke used on Tatooine in Star Wars. So they're looking around. We don't see anything yet, right? And then we cut into the base and we see the pre-launch staging of the snowspeeders, which is awesome because the snowspeeders look great. They look grimy. They look good, right? But they look dirty and grimy like the X-Wings. Just these dirty, squat, ugly fighting ships. I mean, really cool. All the shots inside the base with the ships are really great. And then we get the walkers. We see them in the distance. And then we slowly, you know, we get full shots of them. And they're just the coolest things you ever want to look at. I mean, the stop motion photography, I think it's still fine. Like, I think it works fine. You know, I'd rather stop motion models than CGI any day. You know, if they can perfect the stop motion so there's actually no hitches in it, I think you're better off with models, you know? So I still think the walkers look really terrific. Then we get, as the speeders sort of close with the walkers, we get some camera POV shots from inside the snow speeders as they're moving up and around the walkers. And really cool, you know, really like the beginning of, you know, the era of where the camera would just be everywhere and special effects. But, you know, back then it was really new to have the camera zooming around like that. So initially the strategy, the walkers are way too heavily armored, so they got to do this tow cable thing. Luke's gunner Dak is killed right away, so he can't, you know, use his tow cables, but Wedge and his gunner do it. And it's very cool where they do the tow cable and they swing around the legs 6 or 7 times and then detach. It's cool when the walker goes down and then it's exposed in one of its vulnerable spots and they blow it up. It's really awesome. So Luke is hit, he crashes, and then he takes one out single-handedly with a magnetic grappling hook and his lightsaber and a grenade. It's just so cool. It's kind of, you know, Luke's MacGyver moment, as it were. It's really awesome. But the walkers are pretty much unstoppable, which is, you know, this battle is all about, you know, losing gracefully because the snowspeeders just get decimated and the walkers just keep coming, you know. And there's certain scenes in this where I was definitely reminded, where the walkers really reminded me of the tripods in War of the Worlds. The original 1953, I think it's 53, which I covered in an earlier podcast comparing that one to Spielberg's remake. But definitely got a feel of that. And I think somewhere I remember reading also that Lucas, it was a conscious thing on Lucas's part to like do a riff on the tripod. So it's really great. The walkers are amazing. The battle's really not that thrilling, frankly. Like, you know, there are cool moments, but the structure of the battle here is basically they're losing gratefully. They took one or two down with tow cables. Luke takes one down, but snow speeders are getting killed. But the CGI really shows its age. It's just, it's not as tactile as the X-Wing attack on the Death Star, which I still think is the best battle in the Star Wars universe. There is one battle in the Clones, at the end of Clones, which I think is close to it in terms when they're attacking on Geonosis and the camera sort of with the attacking clones. And it's the first time ever in a Star Wars movie where I think, oh shit, I'm actually in a firefight here. But in terms of ships attacking, like I still think the original episode 4 Death Star battle is the best ever done. So then we get great tension. Like we see the Imperials are down. Vader's walking through the base. Hanley and 3PO, she got cut off from her transport. So they take her on the Falcon. The Falcon is not starting, of course, because it's a piece of junk. And there's this great moment where the Imperials are setting up like a, you know, a big kind of laser Gatling gun, because the Falcon's sitting there. So he's got to use his weapons to sort of push them back. You know, there's a great moment where the ship's not turning on and he hits it at a certain point in the cockpit and all of a sudden it goes on. It's like, it's classic Han, you know? So there's this great moment where the Falcon blasts off just as Vader walks into the hangar and he watches it leave. Then we cut outside. And we see Luke, he watches it fly away just before he takes off in his X-Wing with R2 for Dagobah. So now we're in our Falcon, Millennium Falcon on the run sequence. And of course, you know, 3PO keeps trying to tell him about the broken hyperdrive and Han's just shut up or shut down. And the TIE fighters here again, they're too CGI for my tastes. And one thing I realized too, that there's not enough TIE fighters. Like they would have sent out like squadrons and squadrons to go after the Falcon. I think because the CGI at that point was such a nascent technology that they didn't have a lot of money. So there's only like four or like six chasing the Falcon, you know, and there should be hundreds, which he fixes in Jedi, you know, when there's that attack on the Death Star. Like there's thousands of ships and they all look fake and terrible too. But anyway, it's just kind of weird. But you're only getting like a handful of TIE fighters at any one time. And then it's the Star Destroyers themselves which are going after him. So then, of course, you know, watch this. In no light speed, 3PO confirms it. And then we have the asteroid sequence, which is another great Han moment. Like this is Han's movie, man. Like it really... The stuff with Leia, you know, all of his moves that he makes here and the goofy things that do happen to him, you know, his decision to go into the asteroid field, it's just so in keeping with his character, you know. Never tell me the odds. Great line. I mean, we're rocking and rolling here, man. Like, there's no tomorrow. Supposedly, in the asteroid field, there is a potato. It's one of the asteroids. It's some kind of Easter egg in there. I think you can go on a blog and they'll give you the exact time and moment when it appears. But they do kind of look potato-ish, so I'm not kind of surprised. But the asteroids look kind of fake, mostly. This whole sequence of the chasings, like it's pretty cool for its time, but definitely very dated, unfortunately, by modern, you know, effects standards. And we cut away just as they enter a long cave. So now we get our first Dagobah sequence. We have Luke. It's a great set, too. I love the X-Wing partially submerged, and Luke's walking on it. It looks really great. From the first moment to last, the Dagobah set, to me, you know, the asteroids and Bespin and all that, like, there's definitely a fakeness to stuff in the middle section in the Han and Leia sequences, you know, in terms of CGI. But in contrast, the Dagobah stuff to me is so, like, it's really there. I think I remember reading in Starlog that they created all this and that actual real insects moved in and lived there. And there were, like, moles and, like, mice. It was an ecosystem that they created, that it was that realistic. And, it feels it. It really feels it. And there's a funny little moment where R2 falls in the water and his little part of his little, you know, conical head pops up in a submarine. Ha ha. He gets eaten by a monster and spit out. Little kid moments. Then we cut back to Vader's Star Destroyer, and we get our first shot of Vader's naked head, and it's gruesome, man. Like, the story of him being burned, which you never get in any movie, the volcano battle. So it was all scuttlebutt. Like, you got that in Starlog, but once you see that head, you realize it's the burnt head of Vader. It's just really great. And a great reveal. You know, we're getting these characters are now being revealed as having passed. And then now we have Admiral Piett. I always felt bad for Admiral Piett. There's a moment coming up when he's like, bounty hunters, we don't need their scum. And he's talking like one of his minions, but like a cool boss would, like, oh, dude, we got to go to another staff meeting. You know what I mean? So I don't know. I always root for Admiral Piet, and I'm always, he's sort of like, you know, the poor guy. Is he going to make it? So he tells Vader that, like, look, they went into the asteroid field. And it's just so corporate to me, right? I feel like it's like, you know, a guy going to his boss, like, look, we just can't do the project. And he's like, you know, your excuses do not concern me. And A. Vader, of course, says, asteroids do not concern me. I want that ship, not excuses. So the hunt is on. And then we get some the wonderful, you know, Han and Leia stuff in the Falcon in this cave. You know, Leia falls into Han's arms in the cockpit, and the one point, and these great lines start, like, being held by you isn't blah, blah, blah. You know, and Han, I don't have time for anything else. He's such a scoundrel, you know. He's so good in this. To me, Jedi is just kind of a waste of space, and Han doesn't have much to do there, really. But Empire, he is the man. He is the man. Then we cut back to Dagobah, and I love the Yoda puppet. You know, Lucas, obviously, you know, the minute he could do a CGI Yoda, he was doing it, but I loved puppet Yoda because it's just so tactile, and there's like, and it's very expressive. The only do is like stuff with the eyes and the ears, but like, and the mouth, but it works. This is Henson, man, and his puppetry, right? It's so great. You know, there are the tufts of white hair all around him. So when you're shooting really close to him, you see this, you know, the granular hair on him, and it's awesome. I just love the real puppet Yoda, and you know, the CGI Yoda in the prequel trilogy is, blech, I could care less. We do get this brief tug of war. You know, Yoda's rooting through Luke's stuff, and he finds a little light, and R2 pulls out a little clamp and tries to steal it from him back, and you know, Luke tells him to let go. It's kind of cute, a little R2 character moment, right? And then we cut back to the Falcon, and we have this great Han Leia moment where she's trying to fix something. It's so good. There's so much chemistry between them, and it's funny and sweet. She's like, you know, you make things so difficult. I do. I really do. You know, he's like, well, you could be nicer sometimes. My hands are dirty. There aren't enough scoundrels in your life. I like nice men. Like, just this whole sequence was so well written. And I wonder if Lee Brackett wrote it, you know, who actually wrote, how they nailed this one. Because this is one of the best written sequences in the whole film. It's just, he's funny and charming. And, you know, she's haughty and won't let her guard down. And then finally, you know, there's the big kiss. It's just great. Of course, the 3PO interrupts. We have our comic relief. Then we have, and this is a big escalation in the Star Wars world when we first saw this, right? Because Vader is now contacted by the Emperor, you know, and in the original, it was not played by the actor who played Palpatine, whose name escapes me at the moment, but it was played by a guy named Clive Revell. And then George went back in, of course, and redubbed and re-recorded, actually, stuff, inserted actor who plays Palpatine now into these scenes, but originally it was another guy named Clive Revell. But we get this escalation now and in power. And this is the first time we're ever seeing the Emperor. We're getting the sense of they're both aware of Luke as a power in the galaxy, and that the Force is with him, and that, you know, the Emperor basically wants him dead. And Vader's like, look, you know, he could be a powerful ally if he was turned. He will turn or die my master, you know. So back on Dagobah, Luke fails his first test. We hear Ben's voice, and basically his first test is he just got to eat dinner with Yoda and be patient, and he kind of flips out. You know, Yoda breaks it by saying, this one I cannot train, and then we hear Ben's voice, and when we hear Ben's voice, you see Hamill's head pop up, and now there's a reveal here. There's a great moment at the end of all this where, you know, Yoda's trying to get out of training him the whole time. At the end, Luke's sort of like, I'm not afraid, I won't fail you. Yoda's like, you will be. And when he says you will be, it's the creepiest look. Like, he just looks so creepy and scary. You know, it's like the only time I've ever seen Yoda really scary is in the scene. We cut right from there to Luke on his first sort of training run. He's running around the jungle with Yoda on his back. And Yoda's explaining the Force. I love this entire dialogue, so I want to quote it at length. Yoda starts out, you know, a Jedi's strength flows from the Force, but beware of the dark side, anger, fear, aggression. The dark side of the Force are they. Easily they flow, quick to join you in a fight. If once you start down the dark path, forever will it dominate your destiny. Consume you it will, as it did Obi-Wan's apprentice. And then Luke says, Vader, is the dark side stronger? And Yoda replies, no. Quicker, easier, more seductive. And Luke answers, how am I to know the good side from the bad? Yoda says, you will know when you are calm, at peace, passive. A Jedi uses the Force for knowledge and defense, never for attack. They lay out the main tenets for the Force, and it just gives me goosebumps every time he says it. It's so great. And then we arrive at the cave, and this is, you know, Luke's another test for Luke, and he's about to enter the cave. You know, he's basically given the information, a servant of evil dwells in it, and into it you must go. And then he's told, you don't need your weapons. You know, there's a wonderful sequence, you know, this fight between them in slow motion, which was really creepy, man. Vader, you know, appears out of nowhere, and they have this basic battle, and Luke not lops his head off, and then, you know, the helmet explodes, and we see Luke's face, and it's amazing. And to me, I really take the parable of the cave to mean that, you know, what Yoda is trying to teach him is that with the Force as your ally, you need to attach to nothing. And what I mean by this is that the metaphor here is that you don't need your weapons, right? And so Luke takes his lightsaber and his blaster because he feels like he cannot trust the Force, or he needs to lean on these weapons to protect him. I think Yoda's lesson here is that you don't need anything. With the Force, you need not fear at all anything, right? That's the radicalism of this thing that I think Lucas is very well aware of. He studied Eastern philosophy a lot. And the fact that I think if Luke would have entered the cave without any weapons, he may have just met himself. But because he entered with weapons, what the cave was showing him that it's the things that he took with him and the fear that he needed them is what would lead him to become sort of a version of his father. You know, he would become Darth Vader. And it's the first notion in the film that, like, him becoming Vader really is him becoming like his dad. You know, we don't know that yet because we're early in this film. But I think it's a beautiful parable of what it means to truly, you know, surrender yourself to a spiritual solution in your life and really let go of fear and anxiety and all these, you know, egoistic constructs that we need, that we think we need in life to protect ourselves, that, you know, from one point of view, from Yoda and the Force, that you don't need a damn thing, you know. So just, I love it. So now we are with our bounty hunters. And this is another great Admiral Piet moment where he turns to, like, an underling and he's like, bounty hunters, we don't need that scum. And the guy's looking at him like, am I allowed to talk to you, sir? He's like, yes, sir, you know. So who do we have? We have Bosk, who's a male Trandoshan, and a male Trandoshan. He looks like a Gorn from Star Trek episode Arena, the original series. We have IG-88, the assassin droid. And then we have Dengar, who a Corellian bounty hunter, who reminds me of, in the Dune film, Baron Harkonnen. He's just got a real gross look about him. Then there's Forlom, an ambitious protocol droid who overrode his own programming in order to embark on a life of crime. It's hysterical. Zuckus, who is a Gand bounty hunter. And, of course, the ever inimitable Boba Fett. So we get this thing from Vader, you know, I want them alive. No, and he says it right to Boba Fett straight up, no disintegrations, you know. We get the great moment where, you know, Minox, we have to get out of the cave. The Falcon pulls out. We get the goofy creature that tries to swallow it, which now after I've seen the skit Robot Chicken, I can never watch the Empire scene without thinking there's going to be another guy right next to that creature and they're going to order pizza. So I don't know. It's kind of funny. But another great Han moment, he pulls the trick where he turns around to attack and, you know, landing claws behind the main area where no one can see him. Although, like, in most of Empire, when Han's doing all of his evading TIE fighters and evading all this stuff, he's so in tractor beam range. Like, he just is. Like, you know, especially here, and even more so in the final sequence, he's, like, right next to the Star Destroyer, and he never gets tractor beamed. So I don't know why, you know, I don't know if there's any sort of geek logic to why the Falcon continuously evades tractor beam. Maybe because at sublight, it's really, really fast, but they were tracked by the Death Star, like, when they got within, you know, half a click of it. So just a little nit here I have with George's, you know, tractor beam logic. So, of course, you know, Captain Nita now thinks that he's lost the Falcon, and he's like, you know, I'm going to report to Vader directly, and so we cut away. So then we get another test for Luke on Dagobah. It's the ship, and they're running around, and R2 flips out, and the ship has sunk, and we get Yoda's basically like, there's no difference, you know, between the ship and a rock. Absolutely not. And the classic line, whereas Luke's like, okay, I'll try. He's like, no, do or do not. There is no try. What a line. You know, the best. And he's basically talking about total commitment. You know, in the same way at the cave where It's a total commitment to the force where you cling on and you need nothing else. It's the same thing here where you're like, you know, give himself to the force 100% and the ship is nothing. And I like that Luke continually fails all his tests. He just fails. He fails at the cave. He fails here. He fails waiting for Yoda and having dinner. Because it is an incredibly alien way of life for him. He's like a gung-ho adventurer who wants to just, you know, get in a ship and blast things, right? And he's being introduced to an incredibly radical way of thinking and moving in the world. And I think if he would have really gotten it well, it would have been kind of a boring movie or just a lame movie. And in a sense, if this was a martial arts film, we'd have the apprentice sequence where at the end, Luke is like a master Jedi. But even when he leaves, like, he sucks. He's like, he connects to the Force, but he can't control it. He knows nothing about the way of the Jedi. Like, he's completely not a Jedi, you know? Like, and I think it's smart that they do it. Like, it's just such an alien way for him. So before Yoda actually moves the ship, he has this great speech, which I want to quote. And he talks about the Force. Life creates it, makes it grow. Its energy surrounds us and binds us. Luminous beings are we, not this crude matter. And he pinches Luke's shoulder. You must feel the Force around you, here between you and me, the tree, the rock, everywhere. Yes, even between the land and the ship. I mean, just another beautiful, evocative way of describing what he's talking about. And of course, Yoda lifts the ship, and it's beautiful, and we hear the John Williams music and Luke's great line, "I don't believe it, that's why you fail." And we cut back to Vader's ship. Captain Need is on the ground. I love this line. Vader's basically like, "Apology accepted, Captain Nita." That's snarky. He's evil and snarky, you know, and cynical. It's great. And poor Admiral Piet is just like, "Oh man, when is my number coming up?" This guy, he's dropping people like flies, you know. And here's where we see the Falcon clamped on the back of Piet's ship. We get this wonderful moment now in the Falcon where Han's like, if they follow standard Imperial procedure, they'll dump their garbage. And when they do, we'll float away. And Leia's like, with the rest of the garbage. And she has this wonderful thing for him. You have your moments. Not many of them, but you do have them. She gives him a little peck. So they're coming along quite nicely. And of course, we see it. All the Star Destroyers zip out into hyperspace. The Falcon starts up his engines and takes off. But of course, Boba Fett, sharpest bounty hunter in the galaxy, in Slave One, which looks like an elephant's head, just a really cool looking ship, blasts off behind them, you know, in pursuit stealthily, as it were. So then we come back to Dagobah. You know, Luke's upside down again, balancing stuff. Yoda coaxes him to see the future. We basically get, my friends are in pain. I have to go to them. And we cut away. And now we get to Bespin. As they're flying in, we see these twin pod cloud cars, which are very cool. They look very fake now, unfortunately. But Cloud City still is it's an amazing thing. It's kind of like a proto Coruscant, I thought, because it's the most, even in Jedi, like it's the most sort of metropolitan-ish, high-tech, futuristic city we really see in the original trilogy, you know, is Bespin. Not until Episode 1, Coruscant, do we get like, you know, a massive planet-sized city, as it were. And here, of course, we meet Billy Dee Williams as Lando Calrissian, and we hear that Lando used to own the Falcon. Hello, what have we here? He's such a one. He's really funny. He's a really good smoothie. Lando's awesome, and he's just got this side of him where he's always on the prowl. You know, there's a line from Han, "You little smoothie." And on the walking through, there's this, you know, moment of 3PO being shot. I remember seeing that when I was a kid, and it really, really struck me. 3PO got blasted apart, and the movie just kept going, you know, and I was like, "What? Hey, wait a minute." So I remember as a kid really being kind of freaked out by that. But we cut back to Dagobah, and now we see Ben as a Force ghost with Yoda, basically trying to convince Luke not to leave. Their line is that if you honor what they fight for, you'll train up to be a fully-fledged Jedi, and only a fully-fledged Jedi can take Vader and his Emperor. And, like, that's it. The Rebel Alliance, their whole goal is to basically take down the Empire, and so is Luke's. And Luke really is the only one who has a chance at really putting them away for good. And so, you know, Yoda and Ben's argument is very sound, like, you know, dude, you need to be like the Jedi of the ages to take on Palpatine and Vader at the same time. And you're nothing yet, you know. But Luke doesn't care. You know, like, I love this that Luke goes, he fails all the tests. He learns a little, but not really much. And at the first hint of trouble, he's out of there, you know. So he's really kind of like, early on, Luke is like quite the failure as an apprentice Jedi Knight. another big reveal that rocks the Star Wars universe early on is when Luke flies away and Ben says that boy's our last hope. And we hear Yoda say, there is another. I remember like, what do you mean? You know, that was a bomb in the Star Wars fandom. Like, what are you talking about? There's another. And obviously Luke had worked out the brother-sister angle at that point. So then we're back on Bespin, and Chewie's wading through these gruesome Ugnaughts, fighting for 3PO's remains, which he puts in a box. And we have this scene where Leia doesn't trust Lando, and you know, he's taking them to dinner. I've just made a deal which will ensure the security of this facility for a very long time, opens the door. Sorry, buddy, you know, they arrived just before you did. And Han, you know, the supposedly the fastest draw in the galaxy is just not fast enough to beat Vader. But he does get off a few shots before Vader snatches his blaster, and we would be honored if you would join us. You know, Vader's got some choice lines in this film, man. Almost, I think a lot, so many lines in this film. There were great lines by all the characters, by Han, by Leia, some by Lando, lots by 3PO. Like, Vader has a bunch. Just really, really good lines in Empire. So then we get the torture sequence, which was, you know, a darkening of the Star Wars world when everybody got tortured. Chewie's tortured with sound. And then this really creepy scene where they put Han in that kind of like chair reverse. Vader doesn't even ask him any questions, and he's standing right there as he gets closer. And then the camera cuts away, and you hear Han screaming at like the top of his voice, man. And it was, I remember that scream, you know, when you're not seeing him and you're just hearing the screams escalating up. Really, really dark, you know, very unnerving, even now when you hear it. And of course, then we get the wonderful, I am altering the deal. Pray I don't alter it any further. Lando's continually backstabbed by Vader. That's happening. Chewie's putting 3PO together backwards. You're getting that comedy. And then they're all together. And Han says, like, they didn't ask me any questions, you know? And then Lando enters, and he gives him the information that this whole thing is a trap for Luke. And of course, you know, Han punches him in the face. And Leia says, you know, you really have a way with people. But it's really, we get the idea that Lando is really trying to help out now. And he's made a deal that, you know, the Wookiee and Leia remain on Cloud City, so he'll take care of them. Then the Carbonite Chamber. This, man, you know, another wonderful sequence in this film. Vader wants to test the chamber on Solo, and Boba Fett, what if he's damaged? It means a lot to me. The Empire will compensate you on your loss, you know. Just so chilling. So the original voice of Boba Fett was an actor named Jason Wingreen. And then, you know, because they did the Jango Fett thing and the clone stuff, the guy who played Jango Fett prequel trilogy, Temuera Morrison, now his lines are all dubbed in. So it's, you hear this Australian accent, or New Zealand accent, I should say. I think he's a Kiwi. What to say about the Carbonite Chamber thing? You know, just this wonderful Chewie's great protest, and Han has to talk Chewie down because they'll probably kill him if he doesn't stop, you know, protesting, which is amazing. It's just another time. You know, you have to protect Leia now. And then the great line, I love you, I know. So the background on this line is that it was not ad-libbed per se, but it was changed. Like, Ford came up with it with Kirshner before they filmed the scene, and he said, look, I think this is a better line. Let's use this line. So he didn't say it, like, right there, but it was changed from Lucas's probably horrible version of I love you too, or, you know, whatever that he would think people in love said to each other. And from what I can tell, Ford wanted Solo to die in Empire. You know, he was the only one who didn't sign a multi-picture deal when he made Star Wars. He agreed to make the movie, but he wanted Solo to die here. And of course, you know, Lucas was like, what are you out of your mind? And thank God, because he's, you know, Solo's now coming back in Episode 7. I'm not sure how long they're going to be in the series, maybe just the first one. But yeah, so this is a tough scene for Star Wars fans, man. I mean, his face in Carbonite is really great. I mean, when it comes out and you see him there, and the sculpture they did is really amazing. I mean, really very detailed. Even you can see his teeth, you know? Just so cool. So then there's some brief moments where, like, Luke is sneaking in now. He's arrived and he's sneaking into the chamber, and he passes Fett walking with Han, and briefly as well with Lando and Chewie and Leia, and you know Luke, Leia screams at him, Luke, it's a trap. And then Luke arrives and they have this wonderful duel. So I'm going to digress a little bit and talk about this duel. And I talk about it, you know, if you've listened to my lightsaber podcast. This is going to be repeat material, but I want to put it in here anyway, and I'll kind of, you know, paraphrase where I can. But I want to first digress a little bit and talk about Vader. Unfortunately, I feel like because of the prequel trilogy and Jake Lloyd, Hayden Christensen, Vader has been kind of ruined. James Earl Jones and Vader original trilogy, man, was the best. Vader's one of the top screen villains of all time. It's not for twirling his mustache or his backstory. He's just a really bad guy, right? He's killing employees for messing up on the job. He killed Nita. He killed Ozzel. Killing guys left and right. He tortures Carrie Fisher in the original Star Wars with this creepy needle-toting droid. He chokes people at business meetings, you know. He hires the scum of the galaxy bounty hunters when he needs to, and he's a bad dude, man. And this duel is all about Vader as the supreme badass, right? First, to start the duel, there's the voice and the breathing. So he's looking, Luke is in the carbonite chamber, he's looking for Vader, and he hears him from behind. And then we cut and we see Vader standing across the room, and he's completely and utterly menacing. He's standing in his midnight armor, Amidst this like swirling steam from the carbonite machinery. He doesn't move a muscle. He doesn't light his saber. He just uses that voice, and we are scared, right? And so Luke's great. To his credit, he steps up without hesitation. But look, man, Luke is not even a Jedi, you know? He cannot control the Force in any way. But the great thing is, Vader kind of cops to him that he has controlled his fear, so he's not afraid, and he's willing to throw down, which is amazing. Luke walks right up to him, and still, Vader doesn't move a muscle. And Kirshner keeps the camera back, shooting the two in kind of silhouette, which makes us really feel like Luke's in really danger. And they stand there a beat longer. It's just great tension. And then Luke lights his saber, and then Vader waits a beat. Like, he's so not afraid of Luke in any way, and ignites his own saber directly towards the screen. And he brings it up lazily to this guard position. Which is really cool. And the guy in the Vader suit was a stunt coordinator named Bob Anderson, a friend of mine that I know here where I live, hit me to that. It's not David Prowse during the saber battle here, but an actual fight coordinator. And you can really tell because it's really, Vader's moves are really great. And right now, Vader's like in complete command of the situation. So there's a first combination, and it's shot from across the room. There's a quick strike by Luke and an equally quick riposte by Vader. And then Vader lazily swings his saber back to the ready, like one-handed. Like, he's just like, one, two, and then Vader's just like, alrighty then. Like, he's so cool about it. Luke's got two hands on his saber. He's fighting two-handed. Vader's got one hand on his, and it just looks so elegant and deadly, and it's shot from that far away. It just looks very impressionistic. Luke tries his overhand chop, but Vader blocks him and pushes him down very quickly. Luke falls, but he gets up, and then Kirsch shoots very wide and long as they, with cross sabers at the ready, move around each other. And there's no talking. There's no, you know, it's very in earnest here. And, what I like so much about this duel, and is I think it's the only real example of it, is there's not a lot of strikes. You know, even in the episode one duel, which I think is the best duel of all of them, there's a lot of hitting. And all the duels in the prequel trilogy, there's a lot of hitting. And even in Jedi, you know, when they fight again. But this one, there's not a lot of actual strikes, and there's so much tension in between the hits that it really works, you know, to get you just really on the edge of your seat. It's really incredible. So they're trading cuts and parries, and we can tell that Luke really is not much of a saber. I mean, he's kind of awkward and very big with his moves. And Vader has, like, very little trouble blocking stuff and just kind of maneuvering him around where he wants him to, which is, you know, near the little pit where he's going to dump carbonite on him. And we can see that in the choreography. Like, it doesn't have to be explained to us, you know? Luke is brash and bold. Vader is elegant and deadly. We can just see it. Kirsch keeps the camera back far enough away, and he doesn't cut away a lot. And I just think this adds to the tension of the whole thing. So there's a bit of dialogue. There's an exchange of blows. There's a wide shot. And then Vader does a roundhouse, and Luke's saber right out of his hand, and he forces him down a flight of steps. Vader doesn't wait, but follows up by force jumping down the same steps just as Luke moves out of the way. So, like, Luke's really kind of on the run here now. And Luke gets up without his saber, and Vader basically pushes him into the carbonite chamber. All too easy. You know, there's the wonderful Luke zipping up into the pipes by using the force. You know, Vader sees it, and Vader cuts a steam hose, and then Luke uses it to kind of, you know, back him away, which is really kind of cool. And then Luke force grabs his saber, and ignites it. And he goes for a cut to on Vader, but Vader is just there blocking. And they push against each other. And right in this shot, the sabers look really great, very substantive. You know, and it almost feels like they're bending a tiny bit, you know, which is kind of cool. And the shot is really great, too. It's like this medium shot over Vader's shoulder. And they're standing in the foggy mist, swords crossed. And Vader continues to taunt him. You're not a Jedi yet. And he's backs away as kind of Luke throws down. Now Luke's kind of on the attack. But Vader's still one-handing him. He's, you know, always in control. Finally, Vader is falling, and you hear, oh, you know, as if Luke has gotten the upper hand, and Vader's just baiting him, you know. Then he finds Vader in this long hallway, and Vader's just there with his saber lit, like just daring Luke to make a move. And now stuff starts to get crazy, because this is where Vader lowers his saber, and he just starts force-ripping stuff off the wall. And Luke is totally outclassed here. There's nothing he can do, and it's great. You know, Kirsch is moving the camera in, and Luke is getting cut up and beaten. Finally, you know, he goes right out the window. And when we rejoin the duel later, Luke is recovered and he's walking cautiously down another corridor. And suddenly Vader pops out of nowhere with a lit saber, just starts driving him back inexorably. And this is the moment when it's just, this is Vader's show. Because the way Kirsch shoots it is that Vader just looks physically bigger in the screen, like mythically larger, as I like to say. And so menacing. And Luke cannot withstand this figure. You know, he's just bearing down on Luke with stroke after stroke. And Vader's two-handing his saber now. He's done with toying with him. And he just looks so amazing. And they get out, obviously, over that catwalk. Luke is down. Vader tells him to give it up. But Luke knocks the saber out of his hand and actually gives Vader a shot on his armor, but kind of all for nothing. And the fighting here is great, like really good fight choreography. You know, they're really hitting sabers well. It's very quick, very intense. And then, of course, we have the point where he lops off his hand, you know, ending the duel. But my God, what an amazing duel. So during all this, we're cutting back to, you know, Lando rescuing Chewie and Leia. The attempt to save Han from Boba Fett, you know, and of course that fails. R2 joins the group, that he finds them, and him and 3PO reconnect, and R2 is like, look what happened to me. You know, he's armless and legless with his head on backwards, which is really cute. And at some point, you know, R2 plugs into the Cloud City network and finds out about the hyperdrive on the Falcon. Truth be told, the battle between Lando and Chewie, Leia and the Stormtroopers is kind of boring here now in 2015. Like, it's not that great of an end fight. But then, you know, so now we're at the end of the saber duel and we get the reveal of all reveals about Vader being Luke's father. I remember blowing the doors off me. Even when I read it in the novel, it just was unbelievable. Hamill's performance here, not the greatest. It's been parodied by many people. But, you know, what I love here is as much as Luke lacks the skills of the Jedi, like, the core of him is an extremely noble person in that, you know, he obviously has to learn Jedi techniques, but he would rather die at this point. And Vader is basically telling him that, you know, there's no escape. It's death or you come with me and you do what I got to do. And he chooses death rather than to become evil, you know. And he will make that same choice in Jedi, and brilliantly constructed by Lucas, the only highlight of that movie, frankly, that it is his humility and his willingness to die for his connection to the Force, which takes down Vader and the Emperor. You know, like, it's just genius, and it's part of Luke's character here, where he emerges from, you know, just the kind of goofy farm boy who's got pluck and a little bit of knowledge of the Force to someone who would rather die than become a sort of a hand puppet of evil. And I love it. It's an elevation of Luke's character, and it's really awesome that he's willing to give his life for these principles. And it's great that he reaches out through the Force to Leia, and they save him with the Falcon. And again, there's this ending chase, and again, I have to nitpick with, it's so close to Star Destroyers, and he's not captured by tractor beams, and it's kind of goofy. But there's great tension, you know, with the hyperdrive being off, and no one knowing except R2 how to fix it, and he finally does. And I remember in that moment thinking, poor Admiral Piet, man, if they get away, he's doomed, you know? And like, in that moment, it's all quiet on Vader's ship, and he walks by everybody, and everyone's just on pins and needles, like, who's he gonna kill, man? You know, and he walks away. So then we get our little coda, you know, Luke gets his new hand, and you know, when he's getting the new hand, it reminded me of when the Terminator fixes his hand in Cameron's film, so I wonder if there was some inspiration there. Very cool. And then, as Star Wars fans, right, we get the meet you on Tatooine, and we're like, what's going to happen? Oh, my God, I have to wait, you know, 4 years or however many years for this to finish. You know what I mean? Yeah, that was a big deal for all of us. And there's this beautiful parting shot. I mean, the galaxy, they're standing in the sort of the window of the medical ship, and you see a very, very sort of classically painted shot of a galaxy and the Falcon taking off, and we are out. So, Empire. I have to say, as much as so much of Empire is so great, and I'm still an Episode 4 guy. I'm still a New Hope guy. Because frankly, the battles and the chases in this one, I mean, aren't as compelling to me as A New Hope. Yeah, I think the Walker battle is great on Hoth, but you know, the ending battle with the Star Destroyers and the asteroid stuff, like, I don't know, it didn't float my boat really. It felt a little toyish, you know, in a way that I don't think anything in Episode 4 felt toyish. Everything felt very real. But I mean, my God, the Walkers are great. The Leia Han character stuff is awesome. All of the Dagobah training with Luke is incredible. The Luke Vader saber battle, all of the wonderful shots of the Star Destroyers, the Super Star Destroyer. But George is moving into CGI land now. It just doesn't look as good. 3PO and R2 are awesome, and 3PO has some wonderful, funny lines. They're still, you know, the comedy, besides some of Han's funnier lines, but they're still carrying the comedic weight of the film. So a little bit of trivia. To preserve the dramatic opening of the Star Wars movies, Lucas has insisted on moving all of the credits to the end of the film. However, although the Writers Guild and Directors Guild had begrudgingly allowed this on Episode 4 because they thought the film wasn't going to do any business, they resented the trend being continued on this film and held firm. So first they tried to pull Empire from release. This is incredible. But they were unsuccessful. And then they fined Lucas heavily. And they tried to fine Irving Kirshner. Lucas paid all the fines himself and then dropped his membership in the Writers Guild and the Directors Guild and the MPAA. So Lucas is like, as commercial as Star Wars is, you know, it was done from a very outsider position in the industry. Even the prequels, like, were not done. But since George is kind of like a Hollywood celebrity, like, I think they gave him a pass on the prequels and didn't go after him for using non-union labor and stuff like that. But the problem is it hindered his directing choices on later films because he wanted Spielberg to direct Jedi, but Spielberg was a member of the Directors Guild, and the Directors Guild forbade him working on what they would consider like a non-guild film. So just an interesting little tidbit. And there's an oft-quoted myth that the Wampa attack on Luke was devised to explain the scars on Hamill's face when he got into his car crash. But that was not the case. Hamill did indeed survive the crash, but he did not have any visible scars by the time Empire began filming. So it's kind of a, from what I'm hearing, it is a urban legend. So Lucas had originally planned to only executive produce and finance the film, leaving the directorial duties in the hands of Kirsch, day-to-day producing to a guy named Gary Kurtz. You know, directing the original Star Wars had left Lucas exhausted and sick, actually, and he had wanted to take time off to start focus on, you know, all of his other things that I said earlier. But what happened was Empire ran over budget and behind schedule, so Lucas stepped in and had to take a more hands-on role, and he had to go on location to oversee stuff, and I think he directed some scenes or sequences. And check this out. A disastrous rough cut of the film proved incoherent during screenings. And facing the possibility of financial ruin, Lucas then re-edited the film himself with even worse results. So they had to do extensive reshoots and further post-production work to get Empire to where it is, which blows me away, actually. And it put an enormous amount of strain on his health, his marriage, the relationships with Kirshner and Kurtz. Like, it was a really terrible time for Lucas. Really, really bad. And although it proved an incredible success, he would never work with Kurtz again, and his marriage dissolved a couple of years later. So he paid quite a price for you know, his work on Empire and doing it, you know, and the price for doing it himself, whereas if you were part of a studio, you know, you'd have hands helping you, but you would have less creative control. He kind of burned himself in certain ways. So that's about it for the trivia. It's about the end of my chatting about Empire Strikes Back. Thanks once again for listening to Sci-Fi on Screen, to my returning listeners and new listeners alike. If you like what you heard, head on over to iTunes and give us a review. We'd love to hear from you. If you have any suggestions about the show, you can send an email to scifionscreen@gmail.com, or feel free to leave a comment on the website, www.scifionscreen.com. And you can leave a comment in the comments section of the show page. If you'd like to support scifionscreen.com, you can go to patreon.com/scifionscreen. And that's Patreon is P-A-T-R-E-O-N. And to make it easy on yourself, there is a button on the webpage that you can click. Patreon is set up so you can pick an amount you want to contribute per episode, and it'll be recurring. If you'd like to do that, that is available. We'd appreciate all the support we can get. And you can find us, again, our website, www.scifionscreen.com. We have a Facebook page. And on any smartphone, you can search for us on the podcast app and subscribe. Thanks again. See you next time.